You
well,
worried about, you weren't worried about going over?
No, there was nothing like that. You were always cold, always wet, it was always blowing, you know.
No, I find that interesting because I talked to a fellow who was driving, driving a destroyer then. And he was worried about that all the time, so maybe it's from his perspective.
Well, it depends where he was. Where was he?
In the Murmansk.
Well, we didn't... I suppose we would run... you'd run 6 weeks on end up there, and you'd never actually get any real ice on your deck. The toughest thing of all was the spray that came up would freeze as it was coming back, and of course that would give you icing on your ship. But those darn little drops of water that turn into ice when they hit you, you really know about it when you're standing up there.
Like a bullet, eh?
Yeah, that stings a bit. You know, it's very hard to see under those circumstances.
It would actually freeze as it was coming over.
Freeze it was
coming
over.
And
it'd
be just like what, hail hitting you?
Yeah, that's the idea. Like a sleet, I suppose, hitting you. You know, and that was most.
Cut you up fairly badly too.
It could. Yes. You.
Well, I guess you'd be very covered up as well, but still.
Yeah, you know, you put your hood up and and you try.
Get your face full.
You've got to see.
Didn't bother you though. Just thought it was okay. This.
Oh, I really can't say that. I suppose that the dominant factor was not your opponent, your enemy. It was the water. The water was 31 degrees. Might have warmed up to 32 sometime. And there was a certain knowledge that if you went into the water, you were dead. You didn't expect any survivors.
It was either or situation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, look, we were all right in the vicinity when Scharnhorst went down. There were, 2,000 people on board. We got 35, something like that out.
Well, let's go back to the Scharnhorst thing. Now, I'm just trying to get... Now, you were behind, so I guess you had a fairly good view of what the Dick York was doing. And she was letting go, I gather, and hard, and the Scharnhorst in return. What kind of speed would you be going when you first engaged?
We were following along behind Duke York, and she was good for maybe 28 knots or something like that, so I guess that's what we were doing. But our tactics were to what you call salvo chase. You know how you go about shooting? You place your salvos either up the ladder or down the ladder, or you zigzag them to confuse your opponent. And of course, the safest place you can be when the next salvo is coming is where the last one landed, because it's going to be up or down from it. And so you have some extra speed in hand, and the captain spends his time salvo chasing. And the art of the thing is to be where they ain't. So that's really what we were doing. We were salvo chasing,
and
of course our own guns were firing us in rapid fire.
What does it feel? What's it feel like on a ship when your guns let go?
Noisy.
Just noise, or does it really give it a good rock?
Well, it's a bit stunning after a bit. Yeah, I mean, you get a little...
I think it's a recoil.
Yes, I know what you mean. You don't get a... There's a shock, yes, but that is not what comes across. Eventually, you get... So you're a little dazed, I suppose. That's what it is.
Concussion.
There's not a lot of concussion, and you do sustain a sort of dulling effect.
What about the guys in the turret? I mean, they just, what?
I guess...
Puzzle factory material, or...?
You just...
Sort of sit there and grin, I guess. Hey.
Just keep at it, I suppose. The only thing we all noticed the next day was we fired, if I remember rightly, and I think the number was 640 rounds that we actually fired that night. But we all noticed the next day that our ankles wouldn't bend. Very sore. You couldn't move your ankles. They were stiff and sore. I guess that jarring from the deck. You know?
Oh, God. So, eventually the Scharnhorst, she went in on a torpedo attack. That must have been very exciting. And the Scharnhorst bites the dust.
We went home.
That was it.
We went to Rush Axle.
Now, with the Scharnhorst gone, did you feel the cruiser's duties were over then? Is that the idea?
Yeah, well, the worst of the possibilities was over. Tirpitz was coming along behind, and Tirpitz was, it's kind of an interesting little story which I might relate about Tirpitz. There's a place on the north coast of Scotland called Loch Arabal.
Uh-huh.
And some bright boy figured out that Loch Arabal, in shape and position and in shape and size, was very, very similar to the Altafjord, which is where Tirpitz was lying in North Norway. And the Royal Navy in the spring of 44 decided they were going to have a go at Tirpitz with the carrier force. And Jamaica was dispatched across to Loch Arabal, and on an island in Loch Arabal, which is pretty much the equivalent of where Tirpitz was mooring in Altafjord, we built masts and made a dummy Tirpitz. And then they retired down the fjord, and all the barracudas came thundering over and blew the hell out of the place as a practice run. It gave them their approach tactics and how they were going to go about their attack. And then we loaded all the we went back to Scapa Flow, and the fleet left Scapa. We had the old Furious was there, the old carrier Furious. It's our last operation, I think. And I forget which carriers now. What a name. But I'm not sure whether it was Victorious. I can't remember which carriers. But anyway, there were four carriers involved, including the old Furious. And we steamed up to the Lofoten Islands and launched the aircraft, and they disappeared over the horizon after Tirpitz. Very dull form of warfare, that. Sit there in the sun and you steam along for goodness sake and they go and come back. That's it.
Well, wasn't the Tirpitz jammed right up beside the mountain, though, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah,
they just really pushed
her in. They got a hit on her, all right, and they did damage her.
No, I know. I was talking with General Lane, because he was on a bomber. Lancaster's going after Tirpitz, and just the fire that it could throw up, he said, it's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, well, the actual gun power of a large ship is most respectable.
Well, that combined with all the anti-aircraft defenses, of course, they
around the area, it can be quite.
So
even the ships themselves, when you compare them to army gunfire, you then begin to get an appreciation of the tremendous firepower.
What do you feel when you see the Canadian destroyers today? After been on a cruiser, does it look like a tugboat to you, or what?
No, not really. Not really.
No, you still have a healthy respect for them, or
well,
is it different?
Yeah, I personally, I think they're just an anachronism. it's just not on anymore.
Yeah.
Not really. I don't really think they serve a useful purpose. Terrible thing to say, being an ex-naval officer, but I don't really think they do. No.
So, let me get this correct now. December 43, Scharnhorst goes down, you're withdrawn, and then the fear of the Tirpitz, early 44.
Mm-hmm. That was the next
operation.
Of any size, and that was an air operation.
Now, you weren't punching across the Atlantic on convoy thing, just because you're too big for that kind of thing.
Never did.
I
left Jamaica at the end of 44. We had to write our lieutenant's examinations.
Yes.
And I went down to, lived in the old battleship Ramillies, as a matter of fact, which was moored in Gerlach Head, which is, again, just at the mouth of Glasgow, of the Clyde
mm-hmm.
River. And lived in there for 6 weeks or whatever it was, and wrote our lieutenant's exams.
You didn't get down to Greenwich at all for that, eh?
No. And then left there to go to the destroyer, and I was standing by a destroyer that was being built in Dumbarton, you know where that is, on the north, again on the Clyde. And she took a bit long, left there and went down to the East Coast, down to Sheerness, and joined the Hunt-class ship there, and ran from there. Our job was running convoys up and down the coast and running across to Antwerp.
This would be after the D-Day business.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this was
summer 45, of course.
Winter of 45 there. And there was just about nothing doing except mining was still going on in quite a large way.
Well, what about U-boats? Now, you little mention of it. I guess, what, they take a look at a cruiser and go back down, or what?
No, it's our normal running was at high speed and zigzagging. It was never, they were always just there.
You know, thinking about them?
Well, of course, you just don't engage them, you just avoid them. No, it just wasn't, the convoy was there, and they were after the convoy. If they could have got a shot at any big ship, they'll always take a shot at a big ship, but, you know, so. If you're worried about the mines and if you're worried about that sort of thing, you'd spend all your time worrying, you know. It was just a standing risk, that's all.
Well, you finished this, you become what, a sub-lieutenant?
Became sub-lieutenant in the spring of 45, almost the same time as the war ended, as a matter of fact. Went ashore to Portsmouth and did subcourses at Portsmouth, which is your lieutenant qualifying for, you know, your gunnery and your torpedo and your signals. And that was the summer of 45. And came home in about October, I think, of 45.
Mm-hmm.
Came home in the, matter of fact, the carrier Nabob. And we were passengers at the Nabob coming across. One of the guys who was a passenger there was a chap named Dickie Lear.
I've already interviewed Admiral Lear.
Well, Dickie Lear.
Well, you just see him as he crawled out of the jungle then,
that's right. He was very bald.
Oh,
and he weighed about 100 pounds, I suppose.
He had every disease known to man and some.
He was really
quite a wreck, I guess. Eh?
It was really noticeable that he'd been in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. Yeah, that was the first time I met Dickie there.
Yeah, I spent 8 hours with him last summer. Quite a guy.
Yeah.
Really like him, admire him. He's an admirable man as well. He's tough as nails, and so I gather he was in pretty grim shape then.
Yeah, he certainly didn't weigh very much. I said he was quite bald, and he was still, you know, at that point he was still sufficiently a prisoner of war. He was having trouble making up his mind to do something.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose one trains oneself to wait till one's told, you know, or something. But anyway, he was having difficulty still with his freedom.
Aware, but he was fired in a hospital for I don't know how many months when he hit Halifax.
Yeah,
there,
I wouldn't doubt
too.
That. I wouldn't doubt that. He was
regained everything.
He was in bad shape.
Hmm.
We came back by a, as I said, Nabob, came home here, stayed home here, or until the Navy finally remembered us, I guess. You know, I forget what it was.
You had leave coming, I assume.
Yeah, I had a lot of leave coming.
Lots of money from all your...
Oh, God, yeah.
Lots of money, eh?
And had about 3 months, I suppose, at home in Vancouver. And then during the... While we were in London town, drinking beer at a place called the Captain's Cabin. You know London, you've been there, you know where the Haymarket is.
Yeah.
Well, our Indian Naval Mission overseas was in the Haymarket. And the Captain's Cabin was just off the Haymarket there, so naturally, you go to Canadian Naval Mission to get some loot, get your cigarettes, which are, you could get thousands of, and then around to the Captain's Cabin to get rid of some of this stuff. Start taking the beer aboard. You meet all your friends there. Everybody used the Captain's Cabin as a sort of meeting spot.
became your local, in other words.
Well, not so much. It's when you came in, you went to the place because,
where
you know,
went.
That's where going to see NMO, you'd get what you wanted from the place. You'd have to check in there, and then you'd go down to the cabin, see who was around. Right, and
yeah.
Off you go. But while we were there, this guy, John Adrian Stokes, who I told you about, Jack Stokes, happened to be the staff officer, air, or he was one of the staff officers on the at CNMO. And they were trying to form up a Canadian Naval Air Arm at the time. And of course, as you probably know, that the Fleet Air Arm itself had, it may even have been a preponderance of Canadian pilots in it. In very large numbers.
Yes.
And what they wanted to do in forming up the Fleet Air Arm over here was to mix these with some permanent force officers, of which I was a representative. And there was a group of us sitting in the pub, and Jack Stokes arrived. And he told us all about this, and after a half a dozen beers or so, we said, sure, sure, we volunteer, and we went home. And lo and behold.
What did you realize?
And this is quite true. This is exactly how it happened. But we got back here, and we were going to call from the Reserve Division to tell me that I was wanted down in Ottawa. And they gave me a ticket. And I got down to the train, and I found the rest of the boys who had been drinking beer with me that day were also there. Chap named Bob Cox from Victoria here, Ted Clayards, who lives in Victoria now, Mike Considine, who lives in town here. We're all members of the same class, Naval College, incidentally.
It was a home week then.
Yeah. And we all climbed on the train anyway, and we, and Hugh Jeffrey John Walls from Vancouver. With a name like Hugh Jeffrey John Walls, and a size like that, he was naturally called Hughie. Hughie Walls, and we went to Ottawa, and we did our air crew selection test, and then sent back home again. So we came all the way back. And eventually, we went to back to England for flying training, which is really what you want to talk about. Things you want to get there. And I'll tell you when we got there.
Super. Well, what we can do is I can come and hit you. It won't take too much of your time.
Do you want to get away?
No, it's up to you. Either way, I just don't want to...
I'm all right for another half an hour. So.
Okay, well, why don't we kick her for another half an hour and see where we get to?
Well, according to this, I started flying training on the February the 16th, 1946. And it was in a Tiger Moth, and it was at a place in Scotland, Arbroath. No, it wasn't Arbroath. Darn it. What's the name of it again?
This would be with the RN Fleet Air Arm.
No, it was with the RAF.
RAF?
Yeah.
Just elementary flying training, or?
Yeah. It was number 11. Elementary Flying Training School. And darn it, it doesn't say here where it was. It was just outside of Perth, anyway. Just to the north of Perth. The name escapes me now. We flew there for something like 20 hours.
Well, just get the theories of flight in the classroom and know your way around an airplane. Or?
Mm-hmm. Good old first solo, you know, that sort of nonsense. First solo on March the 6th.
And you're in Tiger Moth.
Mm-hmm. And we were one of the first classes to go through on the short Tiger Moth. They used to do 50 hours in Tiger Moth, and they cut it down to 20. And
mm-hmm.
We went straight on to Harvard's from that. Now, this was an all-Canadian Naval group, and there were 15 of us to start with. There were two groups. There was a group of us who were a bit younger, and there was a group who were a trifle older, and we were split down the middle. Harry Porter, used to be admiral out here, was one of them. Nibs Cogden, one of the older group. Ray Phillips, Chris Smith, who actually owns a house around here, but I think he's in Malaya at the moment. And I'll think of the names in a bit. And Ed Gigg, who's a submariner, and took up flying, spent his war in submarines. And he became the commanding officer of our submarine squadron, by the way. He commanded the submarine here for a number of years. And then there was Bob Cox and Willie Spencer. And Willie Spencer was killed later. Hugie Walds, Ted Clayart, there's a chap named Mitchell, who was one of the older ones. Mike Considine, we made up the younger group.
Did you beat all the naval lieutenants?
We were sub-lieutenants and the rest of them were lieutenants. Half of them were lieutenants and half sub-lieutenants.
So one and a half and two rings, I mean.
Well, two and one, because that's all we had. There's no one and a half rings in our...
Well, you were just one ring.
One ring, yeah. There's no half ring in there.
Except for a two and a half.
Except for a two and a half, yeah.
Okay. I'm thinking of today.
Yeah, that's right. Then we went to a place just outside of Rugby called Church Lawford. And arrived there, flew there on April the 5th anyway.
Would this be with the Harvards?
This was the Harvards, yeah.
It must have been quite a change, I guess, these Harvards, I guess they'd fall out of the sky like a brick, eh?
Well, at the time it did seem to us rather strange, that...
Having a metal plane?
That this thing would... and on a runway, furthermore. You know, 20 hours is not an awful lot of flying. You just barely had got over being terrified, I suppose, you know. And then you were back in something that you couldn't fly at all. And it took much longer to become solo in the Harvard than it did to get solo initially in the
Tiger Maw.
As a matter of fact, I don't think they permitted us to go solo until we had 20 hours in the Harvard, if I remember right. They had one of the laws of the land.
This is peacetime now, too.
This is peacetime.
They're not going to be pushing you along. Would you have an advantage with your navigational training and things?
Oh, tremendous. There's just no...
No comparison, eh?
No, this is what they did notice there. We were going down the way with an RAF bunch of cadets. They weren't anywhere near us when we were doing our elementary flying school, but when we got to Church Lawford, there were two groups there. One group of naval officers and another group, the cadets. And consistently we could outperform these people. And that isn't because you can fly better, it's that you're not being exposed to so many new things.
It's all the same, it's just a different element though, but the principles are the same.
Oh. Well, besides which, you know, they're in a comparatively new service. They're even having to learn to live in a service environment, and we were all
your
fairly
old
experienced.
Old hands, sure.
We were pretty experienced by that time.
Had your ribbons too, I guess.
And it's just a different world, you know. And you're much better able to tell the difference between what's real and what's bullshit at that stage, you know. You don't pay any attention to the nonsense. And,
yeah.
You know.
I guess
it makes life a lot easier.
I guess also too, but I guess they weren't going to give you a tough time in the sense that. You weren't trying to set the world on fire in RAF terms. You were there. You were under RAF control, though. Is that correct?
Well, it was an RAF station.
So you'd be under RAF control, and yet in the Navy.
Well, by that time, the flying training methods in England were that the RAF and RN training up to wing standard were combined. Some of the instructors were naval officers. I think quite properly they reckoned it was a cheaper way of doing it.
Sure.
And it makes sense. There's no problem. I think one of the other things, reason that we got so much out of our flying training, more than the cadets did, was of course we were living in the mess with our instructors. And flyers are terrible. They never shut the hangar doors. They're flying all the time. And you learn, I suppose, more by finding out what another chap did wrong than you like to admit. We talked flying all the time. So we were under...
Oh, okay, that's where I learned how to salute. You were sitting around and having a beer talking about it.
Talking about it. And we absorbed an awful lot that way. And I'm sure that had an effect.
Well, is it also that the Navy, I guess, is not about to waste time with cadets teaching them how to fly when they had, what, sub-lieutenants to do it? I guess what I'm getting at is they had career people who cut the Navy life and they didn't have to worry about them in the same way. Like, you've been through your midship and mm-hmm. you passed your exams, you've done all this, you've served your time, now this is just another course. It'd be a different attitude than...
Our attitude was very much that. It was just another course, yeah. The best course I've ever been on,
mind you, yes, but still.
Yeah, terrific. Right.
So, did the Harvard pull you to the right, or was it to the left that the Harvard pulled? Had to use right rudder, eh? Was that freaky at first, or I think everyone who's flown to Harvard's told me that you gotta, they'll turn you right around on the ground. Is that correct, or is it exaggeration?
They ground loop quite easily. Yes,
they do ground loop.
They were, as a matter of fact, they were a magnificent training machine because they had, you later found out, they had all of the vices of the big machines, you know, the big fighters and the heavy machines. They had all the vices. But the vices were quite polite. You know, the big machine, you got on the Spitfire and it had a couple of, you know, its vice was the same as the Harvard's, except that one would kill you. And the Harvard would give you lots of warning. And yeah, but it was there.
Yeah.
So you, I think it was just about the finest training machine that's probably ever been built. It's a beautiful machine. Because
right.
when you could cope with it, and you knew all its vices, you knew what you were going to face. Probably more ambitious and faster
yeah.
scale, but nevertheless, that was it.
Well, I guess you used to be I'm just trying to think. You'd have the, what jet would that be? Was it the Vampire jet? The RN had the,
mm-hmm.
or the RAF, not the RN, but the RN had the Vampire jet, and you'd be having to change over, but you'd still be using Spitz then?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because there were lots of Spitz around, do you think, more than anything else? Or?
It was a standard fighter still at that stage. Yeah. The Seafire 15 was a standard fighter, and the Spitfire was a standard fighter in the RAF still at the time.
But now I'm thinking in the naval now you'd have to have the Swordfish, and what else? Hurricane.
Well, the Swordfish was just about.
Washed
just about.
Up.
Well, others go around, you know, but matter of fact, they just never seem to die though.
No.
Even when.
Like our voodoos today, so
well,
they stay around.
There's very much a case, I suppose, that people would keep them as pets, if nothing else, you know. The gladiator has certainly disappeared entirely.
Yeah.
Although I noticed that in 43 there were still a few gladiators kicking around in the service. But,
well, maybe what our hurricanes were.
The hurricane was very little used in the fleet era. At any time.
Well, I thought they used hurricanes on aircraft. Or
a few of them, but very, very few, very seldom. The Seafire and the Corsair and the Jeep carriers had Wildcats, the old F4F, and the and there were Hellcats around, F6s. The Englishman didn't, almost all of his, in the big carriers you found, most of the fighters there, other than the Seafires, were in fact American built.
Like the Corsair and things?
The Corsair and the F6, yeah. Yeah.
What do you think of the Corsair?
Never flew it.
Don't know. You have a nice wing design, that's the only thing I know.
Pretty, aren't they?
Yeah, they look pretty. That's about all I know.
We got our wings out of that place. In 47,
great.
This is a place called Church Lawford.
A great parade, wings parade and things? Or?
No, they give it to us in the mass, with a beer in our hands.
And where would your wings go then? Above your ribbon bar or on your sleeve? On the sleeve above your, because of the Navy, right?
That's right.
And what kind of wings were they? Albatross type things or what? Do you recall? Were they anything different? Like, they were different from the RAF wings?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are.
They were gold, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
And they would go above your rings on your...
I never really thought whether they're albatross wings or not. I suppose they are. Now you mentioned
it. Oh, I'm a wealth of information on useless things like that. I was straightened out by a fellow in the RFC because I said, well, what is there, an eagle? And he just started chewing that it was an albatross, I had, you know.
I'll believe
so
that.
I'm just trying to think, though. So your wings go above the ring, and that makes, okay, and that was it. And that was just given to you in the mess. There was no big formal wings parade or party or anything else.
Well, it was formal, informal in the mess, let's put it that way. You know, I mean, the group captain who handed out our wings to us, sort of, you know, did do it individually almost. But everybody was in the mess, and the bar was open.
Makes sense. So then what, then back to Canada, or stick with the RN?
No, then we went to the, there's the end of the flying training.
So in other words, now these are hours, I'd assume.
Yeah.
So you had dual control, you had 74.05 hours. 69.4 and during the day and 4.25 at night, and as a pilot you had 56 hours day and 4.10 at night. Why the limited night flying? Do you recall any particular reason?
No, I don't.
So in essence you had 74 hours dual and 60 hours.
Yeah, that's
pilot.
That's the second half of that, I think.
Yeah.
There's another half somewhere.
I see. Well, there it is, and then the grand total of 90 hours dual and 63 hours as a pilot, and you carried were a passenger for 3.2.
Yeah, those are the long-range navigation trips where two of you took an airplane and you flew to the other end of England. One guy flew it there, and the other guy flew it back, sort of. You know, you got to fly to a strange airfield somewhere, and we
now
flew.
The navigation wouldn't throw you because of your earlier training. Is that correct? Or it helped you in the early stages and you had all
navigation never really was a problem beyond the same problem everybody has when they're flying. The navigation itself actually knew backwards, you know, and you didn't have to fiddle around with it. But the difficulty is that when you come to fly an airplane, you're so busy flying the airplane that you find you've got no brain left over to do anything else. Have you met this phenomenon at all?
No, I have difficulty walking down the street sometimes. Oh,
well,
that's not quite the same.
No, what it is that you find that there seems to be only so many wheels, and
they've done it scientifically. That's why phone numbers use 7 digits, because you can remember 7. Put an 8th one in there, and you've had it.
You can't remember. Well, this is exactly what happens when you're flying. You find you can fly along quite cheerfully. You got a leg. Actually, you can do this, no problem at all. And then they give you a map, and you draw a line on the map, and you fly down the map, and they said, okay, you know, just read the map while you're doing it. And you find you cannot fly the airplane and read the map at once. That is the hard part, is learning to do that. But everybody goes through it. It's no tragedy. It just comes as a shock to find out you're not as smart as you thought you were.
Saw something here. I just saw something here. We're just about, I think, call her quits for today, but Royal Naval Air Service?
Air Station.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. That's, we're hailing way back before the RAF then. Well, Mr. Shimon, I think we'll pull the plug on her because I'm running out of tape. Mm-hmm. And I'll, just to make sure, the date today is 24 May 1979, and we're right on the water on Beach Drive, the corner of Beach and St. Patrick in Oak Bay, on the water, and the date again today is 24 May 1979. And I think that's a little shuttered down for now.
Andy.
Super, thank you.